This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 26th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. And welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Muller. Today I'm joined by Ossian Ward, Head of Content at the Listen Gallery here in London. After his recent trip to Paris, Ossian is here in the studio to provide us with some artistic highlights that the French capital has on offer at the moment. On the show today, pop meets music at a melodic show at the Fondation Louis Vuitton. We'll investigate Icelandic artist Ragnar Kjartansson's first major solo show in Paris, and we'll discuss the hotly tipped new show at the Louvre, which sees contemporary artists giving their take on the world's future through some of the great paintings of the past. That's all coming up here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Ossian, welcome to the show. You are more or less fresh off the train from Paris. How was your trip?
Fine. It was another art fair. So two art fairs in 2 weeks, Frieze Week and then FIAC Week, as it's called, Foire Internationale d'Art Contemporain. That was that, and then three other fairs. But it's a great place for a fair because you're in the Grand Palais, so you're in the beautiful building, and so it's not a chore.
Okay, aside from the three specific exhibitions we are going to discuss, was there anything else that grabbed you in particular among all the other art you've seen?
Well, I mean, you know, amazingly, we're still talking about this Versailles thing, which I've been in to talk about before, the Anish Kapoor, but that's now been vandalised a fourth time and now been gilded over. So we went to inspect the damage there. But yeah, it was mainly about the art fairs last week, so it was very busy. Still going on, by the way. It's still, you know, kind of Saturday, Sunday, it will end.
We did cover the story of the Anish Kapoor vandalism on one of our news programmes. This is with the vandalism that was removed and then replaced, and then he decided he didn't want it removed. And where did it all get to?
Well, eventually? Then he didn't want it removed. He wanted to leave it. But then one of the politicians said, but you can't leave it there because it's also inciting racial hatred itself by leaving it there. So in the end, Anish made the quite elegant and strange decision to gild over all the graffitied spots. So you can still see that there's something underneath, but he had to cover up the kind of offensiveness of the writing. But it's this strange gilding. So it looks quite beautiful and very apt for this royal location.
Okay, well, let's talk about the shows that we are going to talk about today. We're going to start with that one at the Fondation Louis Vuitton. This involves the work of, I think, 26 artists and musicians. It's sort of an attempt to combine the visual arts with music. In practice, how does it work? What do you see and hear when you go in there?
It's difficult to review this show, or any show there, I guess, without reviewing the building first, because it's this brand new Frank Gehry building with the exploding kind of sail ship that's bursting over this bit of water in the middle of this park. So that's the first thing that assails you before you get to anything. I mean, the galleries are better predisposed for art, let's say, than the Guggenheim Bilbao, the other Frank Gehry that we're familiar with, because there's not so many snaking avenues. They're boxes. So what you get is the first few rooms, you get some really great examples of where kind of popular music, let's say kind of dance music, for want of a better word, meets contemporary art. So you've got a great piece by Mark Leckie, British guy, which kind of charts some of the early house music and is video art chopped from YouTube, and was an early example of that, called Fiorucci Made Me Hardcore, which is a great title. But it's shown in a really big room, so as opposed to just seeing on a little monitor, this gives you the kind of overall feeling of being in a club. And there's another work by Dutch photographer Renéke Dijkstra, who went to Liverpool and met all these girls who danced, and you really feel like you're dancing with them. And a couple of other great pieces, one by Cyprian Galliard, which is an actual kind of mad fist fight between two rival gangs in St. Petersburg set to dance music. So they're kind of, there's this pitch battle in this kind of grim outside of St. Petersburg, kind of modernist, failed, crumbling housing estate, with them just going at it with the beat kind of pumping at the same time, and it's all timed to go with the action. It's very good.
Kind of a verite West Side story.
Yeah.
You mentioned the building itself. It does fall into that kind of, I guess, current vogue for art exhibition spaces, which are themselves almost works of art. How difficult a balance is that? so you don't have the point where basically the building overwhelms everything that's in it?
Well, I think it may affect even how I saw this show. So these downstairs rooms were great, and as you progress upwards, weirdly, it kind of starts in the basement. You progress upwards, the boxes become a little bit less regular, and the show starts to peter out, I felt. So weirdly, you end with John Cage, who I would have thought you'd begun with, you know, 1960s, and there's quite a beautiful sort of self-producing work where people can go and sort of help create the composition themselves. It's a randomized piece of music, and there's a Marina Abramovich piece where you sit down and you contemplate the tick-tocking, you know, and the noise, and try and meditate to that. And there's a couple of other epic works of opera. But what you get as you start to come up the building is you lose sense of what the show's about, and you start looking out the window and going, wow, look at that. And then, you know, when you're at the top, you have these amazing views kind of back across Paris, a different view from the usual Tour Eiffel or whatever you're used to looking at. So it's the opposite way back into Paris, and you're surrounded by these kind of almost like wind sail blown bits of wood and steel kind of charging out above you. So you start to lose the thread of what you were looking at and start to look elsewhere.
I guess that may change as people get used to it. I can remember going to the Tate Modern here in London on its first day, and I don't think anybody in that enormous throng of people was paying any attention at all to the exhibits. It was just this extraordinary space and building that had opened
up. And with the first show, when this opened, I didn't go to the opening show of it. People were sort of saying, well, the collection's not that good, but the building's great. So it might still take a little bit while longer for them to get the work that can compete with the building.
Okay, well, that exhibition at the Fondation Louis Vuitton is on until the beginning of January, so still time. We're going to head over now to the Palais de Tokyo for an exhibition by the Icelandic artist Ragnar Kjartansson. And if I keep pronouncing that enough, I'm bound to get it right before the end of the programme. He is another artist who uses music in his work. He has been best known as a performance artist. What is he doing here?
Well, let's just call him Ragnar. Yeah, he basically...
Please.
He is exactly that. And, you know, in a funny way, he's kind of an omission from the other show because his work has become a lot about his music. He's a great kind of troubadour for the contemporary art world. You know, he's often performing strange gigs, you know, where he's set up his whole studio and he paints there and then we'll do a gig there. Or he made this beautiful boat, vaguely Icelandic in look, and filled it full of people doing kind of sing-song, ballady, melancholic things in Venice. So he's got that element to him. But this show is a bit more of a wider range. So it starts with an early work he made. I can't remember the title of it, but it's basically him and his mother in front of their kind of library at home, and his mother just turning to him and spitting at him in the face. And now, it's done when he was a student, so he was about 17. He looks very young. And he looks like he's laughing and she's not really taking it seriously. There's another one 5 years later next to it. Another one 5 years later, another one 5 years later. There's four or five of these screens. And in intervening 5 years, she does the same action. But it kind of gets more serious with each 5 years. Perhaps he becomes more serious as an artist. Perhaps she becomes better at doing it or whatever. You know, and I think he learnt that this first action that he did, he was told by his tutor that it was a load of nonsense and that it wasn't good art. He kind of thought, well, that isn't that liberating, and he started to play with that. So that's kind of interesting because he ages. His mother doesn't seem to age too much, but she still spits at him, you know, 25 years on. And then it moves on. So there's actually a great kind of setup where you see a whole entire house kind of with the front peeled away, and you see a couple who I believe are going to, for the next couple of weeks, because it just opened, kind of enact this ongoing sort of love story narrative where they're basically wandering around this house playing themselves.
Ragnar is Icelandic, as we mentioned, Ragnar, as we are going to call him. It's always struck me, it's a country I know slightly, and it is such a weird, isolated, strange, beautiful landscape. I think it's harder for Icelandic artists than most to not take it with them. I think it's such a distinctive environment to shape somebody. Does he bring that with him? Are his themes universal, or is there something definitively, specifically Icelandic about what he does?
No, you're right. And I wouldn't say that was yet a kind of disadvantage to him, because he's played up on that. He's had people playing music in the snow. In this show, he's got a four-video piece that kind of charts one of the epic poems, the Icelandic kind of heroic narrative, done very funnily and hokily and, you know, without too much seriousness to it. And there's another larger piece, which is a little bit less successful, which kind of deals with the ideas that we have in the West about what is a kind of comfortable Western life. Is it sitting by the lake? You know, it's a very Northern European idea, or having dinner with your partner. So he's sort of playing with those ideas of, you know, landscape and romanticism. So, you know, he brings them up to date. But there is possibly a fear that in 5 to 10 years' time, he's just that Icelandic guy who plays the guitar.
In the here and now, though, before he turns into the Icelandic guy who plays the guitar, is the exhibition worth taking the time out to see, do you think?
Certainly, yeah. I wasn't sure about this larger work that kind of is kind of these split screens about what the West is or isn't. Is it decadent? But all the other works are great. I mean, from who doesn't like a mother spitting at their son? But, you know, the ambition of having the whole house there with the people walking around it, it fills up what are these cavernous spaces at the Palais de Tokyo very successfully.
Well, Ragnar Kjartansson's exhibition is on show at the Palais de Tokyo until the 10th of January next year. We're going to end today's programme with a look at what's on at the Louvre. This is A Brief History of the Future. Now, it's a group show that enters contemporary artists into a dialogue, it says here, with noteworthy works from different eras in order to create some sort of vision of the future. What does it end up actually meaning when you go to look at it?
Yeah, that's it. Probably translated badly from the French press release, which has not been translated purposefully into English, as has the catalogue, is not in English either. It's basically, I think that title is from a French title from an actual book, A Brief History of the Future. And I haven't read the book, but I know there are sort of different chapters to it. And what you get is a look back through, I don't know, you know, Mesopotamian history and antiques and ancient art, and weaving that into a sort of narrative about the present day, ending up with a kind of quite bombastic short video, 7 minutes, about where we sort of are now and the scary state of the world, you know, whether it's migrants or pollution or war or conflict or consumerism. So, you know, you end with this kind of quite powerful message, but along the way you get hints of that. You get a Congolese belt made of string with all the little accoutrements that you might need from, you know, the 16th century, or you might get a beautiful map charting some long-forgotten sort of version of the world. So you get a lot of the history, and what the contemporary artists are there to do is kind of use that history to show some way forward, because you could look at it and think, oh, this is a bit grim, you know, we're all heading for doom. For example, the kind of the big set piece in the middle are these four or maybe five paintings by Thomas Cole, who depicted the decline and fall of the Roman Empire from, you know, Rome just being a place in the countryside to being this decadent place of wisdom and, you know, wealth, and then the crashing and the burning and the ruins at the end. So you get these four epic paintings, and you think, well, how can a contemporary artist compete with that? And actually you have this wonderful panel by an Egyptian artist called Wael Shawky, who's made some epic films himself, but this panel is carved out of wood, and on one side you have a version of the Aztec Empire, the City of Gold, kind of gilded and beautiful, carved out of wood. And on the reverse, as you walk round, it's a charred landscape of the conquistadores kind of coming and slaughtering everyone, you know, so you get this visceral idea. I mean, it could be a medieval panel. It's so beautifully made.
So are all the new works specific responses to already extant works?
To some extent, they're not sort of put next to them in a very sort of obvious way. So these Thomas Cole ones are obviously about the Roman Empire, and this one is about the Aztec Empire. There are other works. There's kind of these, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, ikebana, which are like sort of floral decorations, but there's a contemporary artist's version of them, which kind of include sort of more consumerist objects or contemporary-looking decorations, as it were. So, you know, some of them are directly referencing the past. Some of them are just doing their own work, which has a sort of, there is a grandeur and epicness to this. You know, this is the Louvre. You know, they've obviously gone all out on the moody lighting and, you know, all that staginess is there. But it ends quite spectacularly with Ai Weiwei's made this platform, and into the platform are sunk bits of pillars that have been chopped off, I guess, from a Chinese temple. And you're invited to sit on these pillars. It's like a Roman forum. It's somewhere to sit and think and discuss, and they're all spread out in this room, sort of all attached in this big wooden thing. So you feel there's kind of interaction and social end to it, where you sit and watch this film and you contemplate our gloomy future.
Did you notice patrons taking advantage of that facility to sort of sit about and discuss what they've learned?
To be honest, people didn't know you could sit on it. So it was one of those things where, do I, don't I? But it made more sense of the work. Rather than looking at it as a sort of plinth or a monument to something past, you actually use it and it becomes something present, even though the pillars in it are from ancient temples. They're obviously old, they're scratched by history, and some of them have remains of graffiti on them. So it's something that you don't often get, especially in the Louvre, allowed to interact with the ancient artifacts.
Well, they need a sign saying, please do touch the artwork, perhaps.
Yeah, which wouldn't happen.
On balance, does the exhibition avoid what I think is always a problem with exhibitions like this? Does it manage to not do the thing of sort of jabbing you in the chest and saying, we've got something to say and here's what it is?
Yes, there are messages in there. You know, there's some sort of slightly heavy-handed things about 9/11, but I don't know. It felt like, you know, they'd obviously put enough work into it and, you know, it had the grandeur, had the Louvre stamp on it. You know, it felt like they'd covered all their bases in a way that a lot of these exhibitions where they try and mix the ancient and the modern don't really come together. This actually felt like it sort of did live up to its crazily epic billing and its huge posters and, you know, things splattered on the sides of the walls. I mean, it's the Louvre, you've got to go big.
A brief history of the future is at the Louvre until January the 4th. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Ossian Ward, thanks very much for joining us. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Millett. My producer today was Holly Fisher.